The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, I see you guys are enjoying the earful of a story from High Five of the Weekend.
What a crazy story.
Yeah, very crazy indeed. A few updates of mine from yesterday. First of all, the Artemis rocket that we spoke about yesterday, carrying Helga and Zohar and the Israeli anti-radiation vest did not proceed yesterday. It was called off, I think, with about 40 minutes left to launch due to a leak in hydrogen leak in one of the engines. The next window that could be used for the launch is Friday, so we will be watching out for that. Messages coming out from the negotiation room between the teachers and the government on the issue of teachers' salaries ahead of the start of the new school year on Thursday were all very lovey-dovey, positive, all positive messages coming out, nice atmosphere in the room, good progress in negotiations, no agreement yet, but all suddenly very, very positive messages coming out, almost making parents feel like their children may go back to school on Thursday.
Wow.
So we will keep watching that story as well quite carefully. Just to rival you guys with your comrades' marathon stories is the story of Asaf Stollards, who is an Israeli athlete in his 60s, and he has decided to run over 500 kilometers from Budapest to Munich in 11 days commemorate the memories of those 11 athletes who were killed, Israeli athletes, who were killed at the 1972 Munich Olympic Games. One day of running dedicated to each of the 11 athletes, being done over 11 days. Mm. He's currently doing that. It's about 50 kilometers of running each day. So it's kind of more than a marathon every single day for 11 days. He plans to arrive in Munich over the weekend, and he will end his run at the Olympic Stadium in Munich, which obviously was the focal point for the massacre of the 11 Israeli athletes, two of whom were killed right away when those Black September terrorists gained access to the Israeli athletes. And then another 9 were actually killed during the course of the German attempt to try to intervene. The terrorists were killed. 9 Israeli athletes were killed. There were also German guards who were killed in the process. 5th of September, 1972. We will mark 50 years since that event very, very soon indeed within the next few weeks. So those are the little snippets of updates at the moment that come from Israel. Of course, aside from some of the main stories, which we will talk about now.
We will indeed. 2 Israelis were injured again last night in a visit to Joseph's tomb near Nablus. What happened, Anthony?
Yeah, so this is the third or the fourth time that we're talking about an attack at Joseph's tomb. It seems almost like a weekly event now with these attacks. So the events of last night were that a certain group of Israelis took it upon themselves to go to Joseph's tomb, which is on the outskirts of Nablus, without IDF coordination. On the previous occasions, the attacks have come during a time when the IDF were involved, were coordinated, were guarding the area. This time and last night, there were no previous coordination attempts with the IDF. These 5 individuals just took it upon themselves to arrive at Joseph's tomb on their own accord and, of course, got involved in an attack once again by Palestinian gunmen who shot towards the tomb. 2 of them were injured in the process, fortunately not seriously. The IDF immediately came to help the situation. Apparently, one of the individuals was evacuated to hospital using a military helicopter, but as I say, neither of the 2 of the injured people seem to have been seriously injured, and the other 3 people involved were rescued and ultimately taken for questioning by the police, because entering the Palestinian Authority area as an Israeli citizen is not allowed without coordination with the IDF. And that's quite a sad statement of a situation, because the reality is that for people who want to come from the Palestinian Authority area into Israel. I mean, there are checkpoints involved, and they do need to be vetted as they cross over. But they're entitled to come here, and we see people coming and shopping and sitting in coffee shops and whatever they wish to do without any issue. But for Israelis entering the Palestinian Authority area, that's considered to be very, very dangerous indeed. And there is indeed a law in Israel which says that no Israeli citizen is allowed to enter the Palestinian Authority area without getting prior permission from the security establishment in order to make sure that they are safe and well. And of course, on this occasion, those five individuals violated that law by going to Joseph's tomb without prior coordination. Now, I mean, the issue of Joseph's tomb is an interesting one because it seems to be very popular for people to go and pray there. They go in the middle of the night, the IDF order, you know, organize controls and protection around it. Why is Joseph's tomb such a focal point? What is it about Joseph's tomb? And I try to examine some of the history of Joseph's tomb. The first thing which is worth noting is that there is no archaeological evidence to support the fact that that is indeed Joseph's tomb. There are no signs of, I don't know, remains or bones or anything like that, which one can really point to from an archaeological perspective to say this is definitely Joseph's tomb. It is believed to be Joseph's tomb, and not only Joseph's tomb, but indeed the tomb of his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, whose names you might recognize from the regular blessing that is done on Friday evening on boys, Ephraim and Manasseh, two of the sons of Joseph, who are also believed to have been buried at that location. Interestingly, the location is the second holiest site considered by Samaritans. And apparently the Samaritans in early years used to battle with Christians in order to gain access to the site. So the site has been a site of some conflict over centuries rather than just in recent times. From a Muslim perspective, there is some holiness around that site because of the fact that it's viewed as a location of a local sheikh, Yusuf al-Dwaik, who apparently resided there in the 18th century. And so that is the level of importance that attached to it by Muslims. The Samaritans very much venerate the area, their second holiest site. And of course, Jews from the perspective of the fact that it was used for the burial site of not only Joseph, but also of his two sons. And that's the reason, apparently, why people like to go and pray there and are willing to risk their lives in the process, because we know that it's become the point of conflict and that there are many attacks that get carried out there. And yet individuals like these five last night are willing to go there without even coordinating with the IDF in order to go and pray there.
Again, it becomes tempting to blame the victims here, that they should have coordinated it, they should have done this officially, they knew the dangers, but at the same time, nobody asked them to be shot at when all they wanted to do was go and pray.
I think that's right. I mean, when people go somewhere with peaceful intentions, there's no desire to antagonize anybody around the area. Mm. It's a simple prayer, particularly now during this period as we lead up to Rosh Hashanah. There's a lot of extra prayers going on, particularly with us, the Sephardi community, who are have their Slichot prayers in the morning now. And of course, in due course, also the Ashkenazim will join in Slichot. And so during this period, there is a little bit more prayer and a little bit of introspection. And so it's clear that those individuals had no intention of causing any problem at all. They simply wanted to go and pray. Yes, they should have coordinated with the IDF, and there's no doubt that that was an error of judgment on their part. But I agree that we need to be balanced in how we view the situation.
Absolutely right. I'd love your thoughts on that. 34519 or 061-895-1019. Opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu was yesterday given a security briefing by Prime Minister Yair Lapid. What was this about? What did it cover?
Well, it really covered Iran in the most part, and I'm sort of purposefully trying to avoid talking too much about the Iranian nuclear agreement today. We've spoken about it a lot. It is still out there. It is still a big story. So the fact that I'm not necessarily addressing it in my discussion with you this morning doesn't mean it's not a big issue. It is. And yesterday it was the subject of the security briefing that was given personally by Prime Minister Yair Lapid to opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu. In Israel, the law states that the opposition leader is entitled to receive a security briefing from the prime minister on a periodical basis. And during the time of when Naftali Bennett was in office, he preferred his military advisor to give the security briefing to the leader of the opposition rather than the prime minister himself, even though the law says that it is the prime minister's responsibility to give the security briefing. Yair Lapid, very interestingly, has chosen to take it upon himself alongside his military advisor to give the leader of the opposition the military briefing. The problem, of course, is that now that we're in an election period, that briefing was, at least yesterday, turned into, I'm so shocked at what this government is not doing after the military briefing. So of course, it's been turned into an election issue. Benjamin Netanyahu immediately made a statement saying how shocked he was at some of the actions of the current government, the actions of the Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz, at the actions of Prime Minister Yair Lapid, what they have done, what they haven't done, why the situation with Iran has transpired, and because it's their fault, because they are lacking, because they have managed the situation incorrectly. So that's really what came out of the security briefing yesterday. It's being used as a tool in the election campaign to try and show that when November the 2nd comes around and the results are known of the election and there will be a new government, Iran should know that things are definitely going to change, and we're not going to have the current situation. That was the general message coming out of the security briefing yesterday. Of course, we all remember that the leader of the opposition was also the prime minister for many, many years, managing the Iran situation, and was in office during the time for that the original nuclear agreement was signed with the P5+1 countries in Iran. So, of course, it's been on his watch that a lot of this nuclear agreement has been reached with those countries, but he seemingly forgot about that conveniently during his press statement yesterday.
It's quite unbelievable, but yet not. President Isaac Herzog has held an official meeting with the president of Switzerland during his visit to Basel. What was on the agenda here?
So we are told that even if President Herzog had not been visiting for the purpose of the World Zionist Congress, which we know is commemorating 125 years since the first World Zionist Congress in Basel back in 1897, we're told that he would have made an official visit to Switzerland anyway to meet with the Swiss president and to conduct some business matters, which he has been doing while he's been in Switzerland. So yesterday, President Isaac Herzog met with Swiss President Ignazio Cassis. They met in Bern. And in Bern, they also witnessed the signing of an agreement between Israel and Switzerland to increase scientific research and innovation between the two countries. It was a memorandum of understanding that was signed at the Israel to announce more cooperation between the Israel Science Foundation and the Swiss National Science Foundation, and that was signed in Bern. And while in Bern, First Lady Michal Herzog was taken on a visit by her Swiss counterpart to the museum which has been set up to commemorate the memory of Albert Einstein, who lived in Bern for many years and, of course, came up with these amazing scientific theories. And, of course, we shouldn't forget, was offered the post of President of Israel by then Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion when the first President of Israel passed away. And there was seemingly a little bit of a gap in terms of who might take up office to replace the president who had then passed away. And we understand that Albert Einstein decided that he wasn't fit for the job. And, of course, this was when Chaim Weizmann, who was Israel's initial president, he passed away. And the replacement was in fact, Yosef Sprinzak, who was in an acting capacity before Yitzhak Ben Tzvi took office as officially the second president of Israel. But it was interesting that Einstein was offered the post of president, even though he wasn't an Israeli citizen at the time. And it was even more interesting that he decided not to take up on the job, even though it might have been very tempting for him at the time. It obviously would have promoted him to a slightly different position rather than a famous scientist. He might have become more of a political figure as well. It would have been very fascinating to know how Einstein's life might have been affected if he had taken up that job. But anyway, they visited his home yesterday as part of the official visit to Switzerland by Michal and President Isaac Herzog.
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. And it is just something worth thinking about. What would have happened? How different would Israel have been? What would have happened in his life? Fascinating just to think about it. Anthony Reif, thank you as always. It is 8:01. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning.